NPR's Throughline podcast sort of feels like stepping into a time machine. Each episode, our Peabody Award-winning show travels beyond the headlines to answer the question, how did we get here? Listen to one of Apple's favorite podcasts of 2024 by searching for Throughline on Apple Podcasts or on your favorite podcast app.
Russia helped keep Syria's dictator in power for years, but Moscow, where Assad lives in exile, appears to be warming up to Syria's new rulers.
I'm sure, you know, Bashar al-Assad is not feeling very secure over in Moscow at the moment, given all of these discussions.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Where Russia stands with the new Syria. Also, with the U.S. immigration system shut down, many migrants from Venezuela are going back home. Mexico, this woman tells us, has been very traumatic.
Plus, how airlines choose and pay for safe flight routes. We also meet the Thai celebrity who at first turned down an invitation to audition for The White Lotus.
I said no because I don't think I have time.
Those stories and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for being here today. The new government in Syria is looking to rebuild the country after decades of dictatorship and to rearrange its relationships with its neighbors and other foreign powers.
Russia had been a close partner with the Assad regime that Syria's current leaders brought down, but there are signs that the partnership between Moscow and Damascus is far from finished. Natasha Hall is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington.
As listeners might know, Russia was instrumental in Assad's bombardment of Syria, including places where the current transitional government was governing up in Idlib. But pretty much immediately after Assad fell, you saw these ties, you saw a shift in Russia's rhetoric, changing the rhetoric of that this group is a terrorist group to these are new partners, essentially, in Damascus, potentially. And initially, the talks were meant to allow Russia to at least hold on to its naval port and air base on the western coast in Syria. But since then, it has extraordinarily expanded even beyond that to include potential economic deals and growing cooperation even beyond that, which is really extraordinary and pragmatic on the part of the Syrian government.
So a few weeks ago, Russia was referring to Syria's rebels who overthrew Moscow's former ally, Assad, as terrorists. The Kremlin also gave Bashar al-Assad a home in exile in Russia. What do you think is driving this new relationship between Moscow and Syria's new leadership?
Right. So I think on the Russian side, it's quite obvious. They're trying to maintain especially the presence of these bases, which are difficult to replicate or replace. On the Syrian government side, I think it's actually a little bit more interesting because these were the victims of Russia's bombardment over the course of the past decade. But in lieu of outside support from Gulf states, from the United States, and from other actors, the new government is flailing at the moment. I mean, poverty is skyrocketing. There's a liquidity crisis in Syria. Syria no longer has Iranian oil shipments either. So in order to survive, you immediately saw some relationships beginning to bloom between the new government and Russia, including Russia actually printing Syrian banknotes and sending about the equivalent of $23 million to Syria to help with this liquidity crisis. And this is why you also saw more recently an open shipment via tanker of diesel to Syria from Russia recently.
Where does the U.S. fit into the picture here? And how is Washington looking at this early relationship between Moscow and Syria's new leaders?
Right. I mean, I think this is the most troubling point of all because U.S. is kind of absent, but it's still present in the form of its troops, obviously, its sanctions, most importantly, and the terrorism designation that it still has essentially on the central government of Syria now. And we haven't really seen any movement on that. I mean, we saw a general license with the Biden administration that lasts about 6 months to kind of ease sanctions. But Unfortunately, that simply won't be enough to overcome all of the financial, economic, and political obstacles that this new government is facing. And we haven't seen a lot of movement on that. At the same time, we've seen Israel invade and occupy parts of Syria and really try to create unrest and religious division in a country that has just experienced 15 years of war. And we haven't seen much from the United States on pushing back against that.
I also have to wonder about Syrians and how they're feeling about the new leader's rapprochement with Russia, because the memory of Russia's bombing campaign in support of Bashar al-Assad, I mean, the very dictator HDS overthrew, that must still be so raw. What are you hearing about how Syrians are seeing this?
Yeah, I mean, I really can't imagine. I'm not Syrian, but I was present during the Russian bombardment, which was quite traumatizing for all Syrians. And I know that it is all very raw to them, and they would prefer, obviously, not to have a partnership with Russia moving forward, or even to see these bases. And one of the things that I've heard is they would be in it if there was a deal for Assad to be returned to Syria for trial. Now, I don't see that happening, but there are discussions about potentially returning Assad's assets that he sent to Russia to Syrians.
Natasha Hall is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington.
They've been fleeing poverty and repression in their home country for years. Hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans have embarked on dangerous journeys across South and Central America into Mexico with hopes of resettling eventually in this country. But since the Trump administration shut down the U.S. asylum system, the situation has changed dramatically. The World's Tibisay Isaiah reports on the growing number of Venezuelans who've decided to return to their troubled homeland.
For the past couple of weeks, hundreds of Venezuelan migrants have been showing up at the Venezuelan embassy in Mexico City with the same request. They want to be sent back to their country on humanitarian flights. Most of these people have been waiting in Mexico for months for a chance to enter the U.S. Now they're giving up and want to go home. The Venezuelan government plans to sponsor several humanitarian flights from Mexico City to Caracas with voluntary returnees. But embassy officials say there won't be enough flights to meet the demand. The waiting list is long, and not all people would qualify. This is why Luis Blanco, another Venezuelan at the embassy, is considering making his way home on his own, by land. It's a long journey that includes backtracking through six other countries and the Darien Gap jungle. Hundreds of people are already on their way, stopping in countries across Central America. Blanco says he no longer wants to stay in Mexico because he doesn't make that much money here, and migrants are frequently extorted and kidnapped for ransom. That's exactly what happened to Luz Mar, a Venezuelan woman I met in Ciudad Juarez last fall.
Hola, buen día. Soy enfermera graduada,
licenciada. At that time, she had just been released from a traumatic kidnapping by Mexican cartel members who forced her into prostitution for several weeks. She asked me to only use her first name. Mexico is traumatizing, she said. Nobody protects you here, so there is no point in staying, she told me. Luz Mar's family had to send $5,000 to the kidnappers to release her. She felt like she was in a labyrinth with no exit. The exit was the airport. With help from her family, Luz Mar got a ticket on a commercial flight to Venezuela and arrived home just in time for Christmas. It was a difficult decision. Venezuela is still a country in crisis. So I called her a few days ago to see how she's doing back home.
Hello. ¿Cómo estás? Qué bueno oírte.
Luz Mar says the situation in Venezuela has not improved.
Bueno, honestamente, parece que encontré, bueno, más de lo mismo. La
She
gente
says
está
most
fumada.
Venezuelans are poor, there is no jobs, and people are fed up with an authoritarian government.
$10 al mes que te paguen eso.
As a nurse, the only job she could find was at a public hospital where they offered a salary of $10 a month. She rejected the job and is now making a living reselling cigarettes, water, and used clothes in the streets of Caracas.
Quiero irme, me quiero volver ahí, aquí yo no me siento cómoda. No, verga.
Luzmar then remembered the reasons why she left her country. She's now looking at a second migration attempt, this time to Spain. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
Airlines stopped flying over Afghanistan for the most part after the Taliban took over, altering their flight plans for safety reasons. But as conflicts in the Middle East make other routes more dangerous, air traffic is coming back to Afghanistan, which has led to a conundrum: how to pay the Taliban government for rights to fly in the country's airspace. Joanna Pluchinska reported about this for Reuters. She told us it's common for countries to charge airlines for that access.
In the case of Afghanistan, they charge $700. In the case of other countries, they might charge less or more. And usually, you can pay through traditional banking means. And that's where things are more challenging with Afghanistan right now.
Right. So the conundrum here is how to pay a government that is sanctioned and has all its foreign bank accounts frozen, right?
Yes, exactly. And in this case, that's where this whole third-party intermediary comes into play. So airlines have been turning to these companies called trip support companies. Usually, they are used to kind of help private jet owners arrange permits to fly in and out of certain countries. They help organize your trips and do all the paperwork. And in this case, companies specifically in the United Arab Emirates seem to be liaising with the Afghan government, and airlines are paying these companies to then pay Afghanistan directly.
And so is the question here whether that is legal?
It is legal, because as soon as the airline pays these third-party companies, they don't have to be involved with the transaction.
Mm.
But if it turns out that this money is being used for money laundering purposes, if it is being used to evade sanctions in some way, that's where it becomes legally murky. So this whole concept of using a third-party intermediary is well established. For example, this is how you pay the Cuban government to fly over Cuba. And that's something that's been approved by sanctions authorities internationally. But in this case, because this Afghan phenomenon is quite new, there is no clear guidance on how to do this.
Mm. So did your reporting find any cases where it might be illegal because the funds might be used for nefarious purposes?
We were not able to confirm any such cases. I think this is still such a new phenomenon that these are basically hypotheticals that lawyers are trying to figure out what risks would exist if this were to happen. Of course, another challenge that we had in our reporting is that very few of these trip support companies wanted to even admit to doing this service. And it kind of shows the lack of transparency and lack of financial transparency in the aviation world in general. A lot of things are done behind closed doors, not publicly. You can't get these public records to show how these payments are made.
So can you just give us the geography here of why airlines are increasingly flying over Afghanistan? I assume it's avoiding other parts of the Middle East.
Exactly. So this is a phenomenon that in particular in the second half of the last year of 2024 became more and more popular. We could really see that as the conflict between Israel and Gaza was worsening, that airlines were dodging certain airspaces. Iranian airspace became a very sensitive flight route, and that's actually quite a popular flight route. So instead, airlines were choosing to fly over Afghanistan. And Afghanistan, even though it is run by the Taliban, there's no official air traffic control, and there were restrictions warning to not fly over Afghanistan when the Taliban first took over, it's still seen as a safer route.
You said this is a relatively new shift. What will you be looking forward to in your reporting to kind of see where this money is flowing?
I think we're going to look for these receipts. What a lot of our reporting showed is that a lot of companies have yet to receive an invoice from Afghanistan. So the Taliban says they're making millions of dollars, but it seems like there are a lot of gaps in payments. So what we'll be trying to see is over the next months and years, what sorts of payments requests are being made by the Afghan government? Are they going to find a new official route to actually make that money? Are they going to start sending very large invoices to airlines demanding payment?
Joanna Pluchinska reports on air travel for Reuters.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Archaeologists announced a pretty big find this week, the oldest tools made of bone ever discovered, nearly 30 knives carved by some of our ancestors that go back 1.5 million years. They were found in Tanzania in the Olduvai Gorge, a place that continues to be an archaeological treasure trove. Before now, bone tools were thought to be much more recent inventions. Archaeologist Ignacio de la Torre led the team on this discovery. He says this discovery was a total surprise.
We never expected that we would be finding bone artifacts as old as these ones, because the earliest systematic bone tool production before our discovery was only 500,000 years. I mean, because right. this discovery is 1 million year older than what we previously thought. So we definitely were very excited about it.
I mean, the really salient point here is that your discovery concerns bone tools as opposed to stone tools. Why is that so significant?
We knew already that our ancestors were producing stone tools for a long time. We have evidence of stone flaking from around 3.3 million years ago. So that's a long time ago. But we've always thought that for the longest part of our evolutionary trajectory, all we were making was stone tools. And the bone technology was considered to appear right before the emergence of Homo sapiens, right in the emergence of our species. Mm. And then our discovery proved that our ancestors were not constrained to rocky raw materials. They were also making the most of bones that were around.
So describe the bone tools you actually found. What do they look like, Ignacio? Like, what animals do they come from? How big are they?
We've discovered that these early humans were interested in two main species, that is elephants and hippopotamus. Hippos. Why is that? Because they are the largest animals that you can find in Eastern African savannas. And not only were they selecting these two species, but they were also selecting particular bones from these animals. They were interested in the limb bones. So they were selecting these limb bones. They were breaking them. They were removing the ends of the limb bones. They were interested in the shafts of the middle part of these bones. And then they were flaking these shafts to create a sharp edge. And these shafts were shaped into tips, into points.
I mean, based on your description, it sounds like these large-boned animals with big limbs turned into cutting devices used to, like, chop stuff. What do you think they were used for?
We believe that these bone tools were actually used to process the dead animals that humans were feeding on. So these bone tools were indeed used for butchering, basically, for butchering carcasses. It is interesting that we interpret this archaeological site, because of the sedimentary evidence, we interpret the site as a pool. So there was a water body there. And, you know, hippos are water-loving animals. They have to live in water environments, and they also die in environments like that. So we believe that humans were visiting this pool and the expectation that there will be some maybe dead hippos there that they could take advantage of. And because we find these hippo remains having been consumed by humans, the interesting thing is that not only were they processing the hippos for butchering purposes, but they were also using the very same hippo bones to process the animals.
Wow, that's really interesting. And this discovery was made in the famous Olduvai Gorge in Tanzania, where so much of our knowledge of early humans has come from. What makes that area so vital for archaeologists? Like, why is it so rich?
Olduvai is famous because of the sedimentary conditions. Bones are well preserved in this area. They are organic materials that they normally decay. So there needs to be some particular conditions for the preservation of bone so that the bones mineralize and eventually become fossils. Doesn't happen everywhere, but Olduvai has the right sedimentary environmental conditions for this bone preservation and fossilization. And then also the region is within the Serengeti National Park. As you know, has a wealth of wildlife. So there's always been very rich animal community in the area. So these two conditions makes Olduvai such an important site, because Olduvai is especially well known for the discovery of human fossils. Now, yes, we also can add that not only are there human fossils, but also bone artifacts.
Right. Does this discovery provide you with kind of like newfound respect for Homo erectus?
Yes, indeed. Well, we already respected home rectus very much, but this definitely provides even more respect to it. Yeah, definitely home rectus was an advanced hominid. They had technological and cognitive abilities that have usually been underestimated, but we shouldn't do that anymore because these guys were rather sophisticated in many aspects.
Ignacio de la Torre teaches in the Department of Archaeology at the Spanish National Research Council in Madrid.
There are only about 100,000 people around the globe who speak the ancient language of Ladino. And there's one woman who wants to save this endangered language one song at a time. Ladino singer Nani Vazana is touring the U.S. right now. Before she left her home in the Netherlands, she told us more about the language, her music, and her quest to save Ladino.
Ladino is an ancient language from the Middle Ages. Originally from Spain and Portugal. It's a Jewish language, and it was created by the women of the community. It's a matriarchal language. One of my first memories is singing or hearing my grandmother singing in Ladino, and I always wanted to do something in Ladino so I could dedicate it to her. And Una Secunda Piel is the first song I ever wrote in Ladino, both the lyrics and the text. Because Ladino is spoken all over the world today, I feel that it has to represent a lot of different cultures and it kind of naturally flows that way. By doing that, I hope to create something that can help evolve Ladino a little bit, not only to keep it alive, but also create a new, maybe millennial, maybe Gen Z community around the language so they can help revive it as well. Malicia tripa de madre. Another song that I'd like to play for you today is Sin Ningún Hijo Varón, which means without any sons. It's an ancient text, a poem that I found while researching for the new record from the 13th century. It's about a family with seven daughters, and the father is very upset that the mother did not bear him any sons. And then one of the daughters steps up and says, well, I will be the son you never had because I have the making of a man, and actually I would like you to use male pronouns with me from now on. Si es por la vuestra guerra, la guerra la... When I saw this text, I had chills down my spine. I thought, this is the perfect song for the record, especially in the point of view of what we are dealing with today, which are questions that have been asked 700 and 1,000 years ago. And so I took this poem and I composed the music, and there it is. No mos maldigas mi padre, no mos maldigas mi señor, no mos maldigas mi señor.
Ladino singer Nani Vazana speaking to us from her home in Amsterdam. Her latest tune is this one, Sin Ningún Hijo Varón. Calla, calla tú, mi hija, que es vergüenza y vida yo. Calla, calla tú, mi hija, que es vergüenza y vida yo. No mos maldigas, mi señor. No mos maldigas, mi padre. No mos maldigas, mi señor. No mos maldigas, mi señor. Mi padre,
Somos maldigas, mi señor. ¿Qué te haré, mi hijo? Tiene chas de varón. ¿Qué te haré?
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. A ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas has brought more than a month of relative calm in the Gaza Strip. But the truce may not hold much longer. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has proposed a new ceasefire arrangement. It would require Hamas to release half of the 59 remaining hostages in Gaza and extend the ceasefire through the end of Ramadan and the Jewish holiday of Passover, in other words, until April 20th. Hamas rejects this plan, saying that it lacks a commitment from Israel to end the war. In response, Israel has blocked all humanitarian aid going into Gaza. The World's Shirin Jafari reports on what this means for people living in the Palestinian territory.
The sun is about to set, and people in this neighborhood of Gaza get ready to break their fast. Tables stretch as far as the eye can see. They're set with food in disposable containers. In the backdrop, buildings lie in ruins, a reminder that this area was a battlefield only a few weeks ago, and food was scarce. Today, there's a risk that the meals on these tables can disappear again. After about a year and a half of war, people in Gaza depend on humanitarian aid to survive.
Israel has decided to stop letting goods and supplies into Gaza, something we've done for the past 42 days.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made the announcement, adding that Israel has taken this step because Hamas steals the aid and uses it to fund its operations. Stefan Dujarric, spokesperson for the UN Secretary General, responded to a question about that at a press conference this week.
None of that has been reported back here by our colleagues on the ground. We have seen since the ceasefire is a much freer and more direct flow of aid, and we have not seen any of the looting that we had seen prior to the ceasefire.
Meanwhile, the impact of the blockade is already being felt on the ground in Gaza. Meat prices have gone up so much, says 48-year-old Osama Al-Malahi. Standing in front of leveled buildings in downtown Gaza City today, he says just in the first 48 hours after the announcement, the price of a bag of flour doubled. Stopping aid from coming in, Al-Malahi says, has made life very difficult for 2 million people here. 28-year-old Mohammed Al-Harazin lives in northern Gaza. He says people are afraid that the situation could worsen again. People are hoping and praying that things don't return to where they were before the ceasefire, he says. Conditions in Gaza did improve since the agreement in January. That's according to Bob Kitchen, vice president of emergencies for the International Rescue Committee.
We have been able to save lives over the last month or so of the ceasefire by sending in shelter supplies. We've been able to get ready-to-eat food in.
But there is so much more that needs to be done, he says. Gaza needs medical supplies, fuel to operate water desalination plants, and so much more.
It's a race against time in so many different ways. We've got 2 million people who are now running out of food and clean water. And we've got the aid that they so desperately need that is going to go off and spoil unless we get it to them in the coming weeks.
This week, Israeli officials threatened to cut water and electricity to Gaza if Hamas doesn't release the hostages. The Israeli military's new chief of staff said yesterday that they're prepared to return to fighting in Gaza. H.A. Hellier is with the Royal United Services Institute for Defense and Security Studies in London. He says humanitarian aid should not be used as a bargaining chip in negotiations.
Israel is obliged to provide for the welfare of the people of Gaza as the occupying power.
Even so, Israel is not providing the aid. It's the international community that's sending it in. Hellyer says blocking it is illegal.
All of this is in contravention of the Geneva Conventions, against international law.
Even if some of the aid is taken by Hamas, that doesn't absolve Israel of its obligations, says Tom Dunnenbaum. He teaches international law at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University.
A civilian population doesn't lose its civilian character in virtue of the presence of combatants within it. To deny sustenance to the population as a whole is to collectively punish that population for the actions of the combatants.
Israeli officials say that there is enough food in Gaza to cover the needs of people for the time being. But the United Nations estimates that more than 3,000 children have been diagnosed with acute malnutrition since January of this year. It says depriving Gaza of aid can worsen the situation. For Fatima Al-Absi in northern Gaza, this Ramadan is like no other. I lost the most important thing, she says, which is my husband and my son-in-law. They were killed in the war. She's now returned to her destroyed home and is trying to make it livable again. We don't want war, she says. We want peace and security and for all countries to stand with us. President Trump warned Hamas last night in a post on social media. He said they should release the hostages or there would be, quote, hell to pay. The White House confirmed yesterday that the U.S. is negotiating directly with the group, a complete reversal of its past policy. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
British tennis pro Emma Raducanu is in Indian Wells, California, for her first tournament since competing in Dubai last month, where she said that she fought back tears as she played. That's because a man accused of stalking her was sitting near the front row in the stands. Raducanu eventually went to the umpire on the court and explained what was happening. Video of the incident put a spotlight on the problem with stalkers following female athletes. Lindsay Gibbs is a sports reporter who also writes a newsletter called Power Plays about sexism in sports.
It's really scary. She was playing on one of the side courts, which if you've ever been to a tennis tournament, they're the big courts. But then there are these really small, intimate courts.
Right.
So she saw this man and, you know, like you said, ended up in tears and really distraught throughout the match. She did report it. He was banned from all WTA matches. She signed a restraining order, which I think she did drop in order for him to agree to stay away from WTA matches. But what a horrifying incident.
And do we know any details about this man's pattern of behavior before he showed up at this tournament in Dubai?
We know that he had been at other tournaments. We know that he had come up to her and expressed fixated patterns of behavior is what has been released, I think, with personal notes and gifts, enough to really sound the alarm bells. So Emma Raducanu had already alerted officials before the match of this man. People did have his picture to look out for, but he was still able to get into the tournament.
Emma Raducanu was visibly upset by his presence. What else has she said about the incident?
She's beefed up her security. You know, she took a little time in Dubai after the Dubai tournament to gather herself. She's had stalkers before. She had stalker show up to her home in 2022. But she's also talked really defiantly about not letting, you know, what she kind of calls these creepy old men take her career away from her.
I mean, what she went through sounds like such an intense experience. The stands are so close to the players, right? And I can imagine, given the pressure of the tennis world and the heat of the match and the moment, they must feel like they have nowhere to go, those players. Has this been a problem for a while in women's tennis?
Yeah, well, of course. I mean, women's tennis, it's, you know, Monica Seles was stabbed, right?
1993 match against,
she was, you know, on court and a spectator came and ran on the court and stabbed her, like, in the middle of a match while she was sitting on the changeover. And it really derailed her career. She was able to return, but she was never the same. She never reached the same height. Apparently a fan of one of her opponents who wanted to hurt her, you know, deranged, obviously mentally ill. But my God, if you're a woman in tennis, that stays with you. There has been stalking for tennis players and for female athletes in general. And now there's this whole subset of autograph seekers and selfie seekers and memento seekers that's really turned it into almost a game for grown men to be chasing after these women. And Gabby Thomas, an Olympic runner for the United States, talked about having this group of men following her in airports. They seem to always know where her gate is. She feels like they're being tipped off by security, by people in the airport. Simone Biles and Coco Gauff, another tennis player, said in the comments that they had experienced the same thing in airports with groups of men. The same group of men seemingly always knowing where these women were going to be on these flights.
I'm guessing that security in Indian Wells is alert and vigilant because of Dubai and the past history. What do you think the biggest lesson from this whole episode is, Lindsay?
I think it's just that we can never be too comfortable, and I hate that. But I also think there have been a few other stories that have been in the news lately in women's sport, not with bad actors as strangers, but with bad actors within the women's sports themselves, whether it's the abusive coaching relationship that Elena Rybakina is dealing with, and the WTA has banned her coach, who she is also seeing, from being on the tour right now because he's abusive. You had the big women's football incident from the Women's World Cup that just went to trial, where Luis Rubiales, the president of the Spanish Federation, kissed one of his players on the mouth during the World Cup celebration, Jenny Hermoso, and that just went to trial. And he was convicted guilty, but given a very little penalty.
Right.
There are a lot more safety concerns, both from strangers and from people within the sport themselves, dangers right now facing women in sport.
What do you think sports officials or police should be thinking about in light of the Raducanu incident and others in women's sports?
There needs to be beefed up security in all courts. You need systems in place so that if someone is banned from the tournament, how exactly are we making sure that this man never gets in again? These things are hard to take in place. And in addition to that, we just need better education for athletes about the resources that are available to them, when they can go to law enforcement, when they can access therapy, ways to help them face these dangers mentally and physically to improve their safety is the only way forward.
Lindsay Gibbs is a sports reporter. Her newsletter, Power Plays, is all about sexism in sports.
Staying with sports, a surprise proposal from South America would add a bunch more teams to soccer's biggest tournament, the World Cup. The last men's World Cup had 32 teams. This would bring 64 teams to the 2030 tournament. The Associated Press says Uruguay put forward this new proposal to dramatically boost the number of teams. That event is already set to be the most sprawling World Cup ever, with six host nations spread across three continents.
Researchers are seeing a worrying trend. Young people around the world are experiencing record levels of despair.
Young people are telling us they are in crisis, and we absolutely have to listen to what they're telling us.
The weather outside is cold, dark, and it's going to be just like every other day, a day spent alone.
I've been in four different adolescent units and two adult mental health units.
Anxiety, body image and bullying, just some of the issues they face.
New research sponsored by the UN finds that young people are so unhappy that they've changed a fundamental pattern of happiness. The World's Sarah Birnbaum explains.
The U-curve theory of happiness has been accepted wisdom going on two decades. The idea is, if you plotted happiness throughout the human lifespan on a graph, starting as a teenager until old age, it would follow a U-shaped pattern. So we start out pretty cheerful, we're young, we're healthy, and then things start going downhill. All those adult responsibilities start weighing on us. Maybe those dreams of becoming a rock star don't quite pan out. Happiness reaches a nadir, otherwise known as the midlife crisis. And then it starts rising again in our 50s as we gain wisdom, perspective, and maybe a little nest egg.
This pattern was basically everywhere. I wrote an article in 2021 where I basically showed that this was present in 145 countries.
This is David Blanchflower, an economist at Dartmouth University with a specialty in happiness and well-being. He wrote one of the first papers about the U-curve in 2008. Now, we're talking averages here, and the U-curve can't predict any one person's happiness. But decades of research has borne this out, and the pattern has held true for data reaching as far back as 1973.
I think there were 600 or so published papers showing the U-shape. And it looked like a hugely widely seen phenomenon.
Until it wasn't. Blanche Flower and his colleagues have released a working paper through the National Bureau of Economic Research and commissioned by the UN that studies data on life satisfaction across six English-speaking countries, the US, the UK, Ireland, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand.
I looked at the data and I went, oh my goodness me, there is no U-shape anymore.
The graph now looks like a diagonal line shooting up to the right, putting humans in uncharted territory. What's happened since 2013 is the midlife crisis appears to be gone, but it's not that people are happier at 45, it's that they're much more miserable when they're young adults. The data from the study comes from the CDC questionnaires and similar surveys in other countries that ask questions like, over the last 30 days, how often have you felt depressed, stressed out, or on edge? Now, let's just look at the United States for a moment, Blanche Flower says.
So if I take something like 18 to 25-year-old girls, 10% of them say, every day of my life is a bad mental health day. 10 years ago, it was 3%.
The trends are starkest in the U.S., but similar patterns are emerging in the other wealthy Anglophone countries. The members of Gen Z are suffering from anxiety, depression, and self-harm at levels higher than any generation for which we have data. The question is why, and here's where people disagree. Blanche Flower believes it's the rise of cell phones and social media causing social isolation and chronic anxiety. Carol Graham, an economist at Brookings who is not involved in the research, says she believes it's a mix of things. Uncertainty in the labor market, the cost of housing and education, income inequality.
Years ago, you kind of had a sense if you completed certain steps, you'd have a good job and you'd have health insurance and be able to have a family and eventually have a house. That just was kind of how it was, right? And it's not that way anymore. So there's uncertainty about what's next, and there's not enough guidance about how to navigate all this.
Detractors say that theory wouldn't explain why rates of anxiety and depression suddenly shot up in 2013, nor would it explain why teen mental health collapsed in similar ways around the same time in Canada, the UK, Australia, and New Zealand. But disagreements aside, Graham says the mere fact that the U-curve is no more and the general contour of human happiness has changed should make us all very concerned. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Two South Korean fighter jets accidentally dropped 8 bombs on a populated area today. It happened during a military exercise with U.S. forces near the North Korean border. 6 civilians and 2 soldiers were injured. One witness described loud sounds that made her think a war had broken out.
The South Korean Air Force apologized, saying the bombs fell outside of a firing range by accident during the live fire exercise. The mayor of a town nearby urged military officials to call off the exercises until they can reliably prevent another tragic incident.
The city of Pochon has a population of about 140,000, along with 3 major firing ranges used by the South Korean and U.S. armed forces. Late today, the military said it decided to suspend all live fire drills across South Korea. The Air Force also said a committee would investigate today's incident and determine the scale of the damage. Now, even if you have never seen the HBO show The White Lotus, you've probably heard people talking about it. The premise is basically rich Americans behaving badly in warm, luxurious places. The latest season is set in Thailand. It is stacked with American celebrities and also features a Thai actress whose biggest break has come in the twilight of her career. The World's Patrick Nguyen sat down to speak with her in Bangkok.
Most actors would cross Siberia barefoot to audition for The White Lotus. Then there's Pachawadi Michuton. She didn't even want to go across town.
One day somebody called and said, please come for audition for White Lotus. But I said, no, because I don't think I have time.
Pachawadi could have made time. She had been a very famous actress in Thailand decades ago. But at 77 years old, she was retired from the screen, having long since given up on any Hollywood dreams. A while later, her phone rang again.
They said, could Mike White want to meet me at the Oriental Hotel?
Mike White is the triple Emmy award-winning director of The White Lotus. He was in Bangkok pursuing her, pushing Pachawadi, who has the look and bearing of a Thai Judy Dench, to play a key role. A silver-haired Bangkok woman with an aristocratic demeanor, the owner of the fictional White Lotus Resort.
And I thought, well, coming to meet a famous director is kind of a good deal for me. So I came just to tell him that I'm not ready, you know, but I just love to meet him.
Why was one of Hollywood's hottest directors so hung up on this actress whose star had faded? Well, once you learn a bit about Pachawadi's life, it all makes sense. I found Pachawadi by the Chao Phraya River in Bangkok, an area lined with glittering Buddhist temples. Pachawadi grew up in a big house right here. She was the daughter of a woman close to Thailand's royal family.
She was kind of a lady in waiting for the king, but in the evening she reads for the queen.
Her mother's connections paid off. She left the palace and secured a lucrative license to operate ferries on the river. Pachawadi was groomed to take over her mom's ferry business. But as a kid, Pachawadi was more interested in these ragtag theater troupes that would come perform at the temples by the river.
I sneaked out with my nanny to watch because my mother doesn't want me to go out at night, you know. And I was very impressed, and it was my dream to be doing something like that.
Problem was, Thailand's upper crust held a dim view of entertainers.
They call it a low profession. It's not suitable for our family. But I like it, you know.
She liked it so much that as a young woman, she shirked business courses for acting classes. She even moved to L.A., hoping to break into film.
Everybody, when they were young, they think of Hollywood, you know. I went to many auditions, and I got extras here and there, low-grade movies, that kind of thing. And I thought I'd better come back to my country. It's more dignified.
Back in Thailand, in 1973, she got herself a starring role in a film about a romance gone wrong called Mai Mi Sawan Samrap Kun. For you, there is no heaven.
Mai Mi Sawan Samrap Kun Samrap Kun Sawan Mai Mi.
It was a big hit. Pachawadi won Thailand's version of the Oscar, and it was presented to her by none other than the king. Her mom had to admit it, that was impressive. Pachawadi got more roles in Thai cinema, but felt the jobs lacked sophistication.
Thai movies, yeah, they didn't have scripts. They kind of write the scripts along the way.
Hollywood also used to do this in the 30s, write scripts on the fly to turn around movies fast and cheap.
And I said, I can't do that because I have to know what I'm doing. That's why I say no.
Pachawadi started turning down films and TV shows. Then in the 90s, she opened her own theater by the river, where she used to watch those traveling performers as a kid. She built a sanctuary for high-end Thai productions, catering to more discerning crowds. She gave up superstardom, but found contentment, serving as the godmother of Thai theater.
I don't like to be in the limelight. I don't like red carpets and all that thing. I want to be quiet and perform and be a normal human being.
That is pretty much what Pachawadi told White Lotus director Mike White when she saw him face to face, saying, you don't need me for your show. I'm not even a big star anymore.
The theater people know me, but the general audience, especially the young people, they don't know me.
But that experience made her perfect for this role. He insisted she play the well-to-do owner of the White Lotus Resort, a woman named Sitala, who used to be a singer but lost her fame and now performs for the hotel guests.
She was a star, which I know how it feels. A star, when they get old, they get forgotten.
Now Pachawadi understood. She took the job. And here she is, in character, as the crooning resort boss. Pachawadi now feels like her career has a second wind. Thai TV has come a long way, and she's giving it another shot. Because of her newfound global fame, a Thai channel has offered her a 12-part series that she will create.
I'll be acting, writing, directing, producing. Because Thailand doesn't have that much budget. Compared to White Lotus, I think it's not even 1%. But I told my people that we can do it. Thai people can do anything, you know.
And yes, her actors will get fully written scripts well before they shoot. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. See you back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Craig Landon, Steve Henn, Ravi Mohan, Joelle Chase and Peter Nipper, Bia Lowe, and William Reynolds. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.